Welcome to Season 2 of The Wayfarer's Guide to World Building, a podcast for writers by Mythos & Inc. Publishing. I'm Kyle.
I'm Emma.
I'm Allison.
And I'm Christiana.
Hello. You may have missed us during our unexpected hiatus. We're a small crew and life happens, so we've missed a couple episodes. But to make up for it, you'll be getting weekly episodes until May 4th, Star Wars Day. After that, we'll return to our regular posting schedule. And with that, today's trope, the government is out to get us, also known as evil empires and corrupt political systems. Special thanks to our patrons for making this episode possible. If you're a patron, send us your writing, world building, or publishing questions for us to answer in our bonus Q&A episodes, which we record as a thank you to our Patreon supporters. Want your character to face off against impossible odds? Pit them against a corrupt evil empire who's hiding something important from the people or taking advantage of them in some way? This trope usually involves oppression of the masses and a hierarchy of a few people who benefit from the system while many others suffer. Unfortunately, deeply relatable. With that, I'm going to pass it to Emma.
Yes. So today I'm going to be talking about the Canadian political system. I'm just kidding. No, we're going to talk about fictional examples. So most likely everyone listening is familiar with the Hunger Games franchise, which is, of course, a best-selling YA series, as well as a movie trilogy, in quotes, because, of course, they did the thing where they split the last movie into two, which everybody's been doing since Harry Potter came up with it. So it's four movies, whatever. But The Hunger Games is set in a dystopian future where civilization as we know it has fallen, and what was once the United States has crumbled and been replaced by a nation called Panem. Panem is divided into 13 areas known as districts, each one responsible for a different sort of export like coal, livestock, fish, etc. This nation is ruled by a totalitarian regime housed in the aptly named capital. The system is wildly and blatantly corrupt, with the residents of the capital being mind-bogglingly wealthy, while many citizens in the nation's poorest district are literally starving. Not only that, but to maintain power, the capital hosts the titular Hunger Games every year, where two children from each district are randomly selected to participate in a battle royale fight to the death for the amusement of the masses. This is to remind the districts that their very lives are owned by the governing powers and keep them so beaten down that they never even think of rising up or challenging the status quo. This is awful, but it is great world building. And I think it's great world building because it works even though it's very unrealistic. Now, I'm not going to get into a whole political discussion, although that is the topic of the podcast, but you know, that could go on for hours. So just as a general rule, real life totalitarian regimes generally don't try and actively make their citizens hate them, by taking their children and making them fight to the death on live TV. Usually it's more of a propaganda to make the outside world the enemy, keeping them very isolated and insular. However, and of course, this is not what Panem does. Panem very much makes the capital the enemy of the citizens, which is not realistic. However, it works because we as readers buy into it. It works within the story, and that's what matters. So it really just shows you don't always have to worry about making your world building super realistic. You just need to make it so that readers or watchers or players, depending on your format, are going to buy into the premise. And usually you can do that by making your characters really good, making the story really good, and making your readers want to buy into your world.
This topic is unfortunately maybe very close to my heart because I work for the government in communications. Oh,
I thought you were going to say because when I was young I had to volunteer.
I had to fight to the death in the Hunger Games. No, I work for the government in communications, and I feel like often people view what we're saying as like the Hunger Games, when in reality I'm just trying to put out a news release saying the playground has opened up kind of thing. So I haven't read the books, but I have seen the movies, and I understand that movies and books are often very much not the same thing, but I'm curious, is there propaganda in the series? Like, is, so you mentioned that they don't try to be the good guys. Is there any thing in the series where the capital is really trying to portray themselves as the good guys, or that the Hunger Games is a good thing? Like, are they trying to convince the citizens and it's just not working, or are they not trying at all?
I mean, I think they do insofar as they kind of really hype up the fact that the winner of the Hunger Games gets to live in luxury for the rest of their lives, right? So it's like, oh, sure, you had to go through this, but you get to be super rich and live out your days in comfort. And isn't that great, sort of thing? And you can definitely see that the citizens of the capital itself very much believe that, like, they, because the capital is not just the government, it's also, it's a city, so there's actual just, you know, regular people who live there and do their work and whatnot. They're just all, you know, really wealthy and in a bubble, kind of like the, you know, 1% elite, if you will. And so they very much, you know, think that they're good and they don't see a problem with this, and they're like, oh yeah, you know, you get to, it's taking these people from these, you know, their poor circumstances and getting, they have an opportunity to get something better. And they kind of just gloss over the fact that, you know, they're traumatized because they had to kill a bunch of other children. While the government doesn't do a whole lot to make all of their citizens think they're doing the right thing, there definitely are some of them that totally buy into the system for sure.
Interesting.
Now, if I recall, because it's been a few, it's been probably a decade since I've encountered the Hunger Games story. But if I recall correctly, like, in the beginning, there's like the people just kind of accept their lot. But then as the story builds and grows, there's this growing rebellion. How does that come out? Where do the people's emotions change? And do you see a transition of, like, does the good guy become the bad guy at any point in that, where, you know, they start to gain power through rebellion? And are they going to be the bad guy now?
Yes. Yeah. So that is kind of one of the realistic parts of revolutions is, as a history teacher I had once said, is revolutions eat their children, which is sort of like, whenever you have a revolution, you tend to go back to the same patterns, just now with the formerly oppressed people in the now totalitarian roles. So yeah, the Hunger Games, of course, the whole sort of premise is this rebellion. So Katniss, the main character, manages to sort of game the system a little bit, and so she and the other participant from her district both end up winning the first games, which is not supposed to happen. They did it by kind of cheating a little bit, which makes the Capitol very upset, because this shows that there are ways of, you know, getting around the system and of challenging their power, and they do not want anybody to believe that. So Katniss does her best to kind of try to stay out of the spotlight and not act like a figurehead for this revolution. However, it's kind of out of her control at that point. People are sort of starting to flock to her, becomes a whole thing. They end up doing a revolution.
No, they're just doing revolution.
They're doing a revolution. They do manage to oust the ruling class. However, the new appointed leader, who is set up by the districts, then suggests, well, we should keep on doing the Hunger Games, but now with kids from the Capitol, give them a taste of their own medicine, you know, show them that they can't crush us or whatever. It's like, well, now that's just the same thing, but a different ruling class. And so in the end, Katniss actually ends up assassinating the new leader to keep that sort of Hunger Games thing from continuing. So it's a very interesting look. I really actually like that part of the story, is that it's an interesting look of how easily people go from being oppressed to being the oppressors once they get power.
This is all very Animal Farm. Hey.
Yes. Yep.
Ooh. Yeah.
Yep.
No, there is a good example too. Animal Farm would have been a great example.
Animal Farm
this.
Is very
That's a bonus resource. Everybody can go read Animal Farm. And
yes.
Then,
Everything is already based off of it. So we're good.
Yeah. Anything political, Animal Farm.
Animal Farm. Is it my turn to give an example? Because I can say that mine could be based off of Animal Farm for sure. So mine is both a TV series and a book series. And I haven't read the entirety of the book series, but I have watched the entirety of the TV series. The story, it's science fiction called The Expanse. My history with this is that I first watched like the first couple of episodes and I thought, not really my thing, not really into it. And then once about the fourth season came out, I went back and rewatched it and said, I was totally wrong. I was gripped. I could not look away. The story of this is that it centers around a world where humanity has colonized our solar system. And it's primarily split into three different powers. You have Earth and Luna, Earth and the Moon. So there's those two colonies together represented. They're called the United Nations. Then you have the Martian Congressional Republic. These are the people that have habitated on Mars and are trying to make it a livable environment as a planet, not just like structures and stuff. And then you have the outer planets, or the Outer Planet Alliance, the OPA, also known as Belters, which is not always the most politically correct term It's usually used in a derogatory sense until they start to reclaim that for themselves. And these are the people that are like miners in the asteroid belts. They operate like very loosely, like a clan based, almost like your Highland structure of various clans and families working together and then exchanging of people for breeding purposes, etc. So that's kind of the three main powers in this entire universe. And it begins with a United Nations ship that ends up coming aboard a big, massive Mars vessel, that like a huge Mars warship that has just been completely destroyed. And they watch it happen from this ship that they don't recognize. Nobody recognizes it. It's not, it doesn't seem like a human ship. It doesn't seem like, and this question ends up, another Martian ship shows up. They accuse them of doing it. And there's a whole bunch of politics that kind of happens around this. Through this, we end up seeing that this crew in this small little ship called the Rocinante, which is a stolen Martian ship, is piloted by people from the United Nations. There is somebody from Mars that is a pilot on there. There's another person, and there's another person from the OPA, from the Belters, who has joined on. You have this one little ship that is kind of navigating the politics of three major galaxy powers. And they're both loved and hated by everyone at the same time, while they're just trying to save humanity. And throughout the entirety of all of these seasons, there are various power vacuums that end up being created. New things are introduced. There's a new discovery of this particle that is extremely powerful and can create these beings that are just incredibly deadly. Who's going to keep that? And if somebody gets it, suddenly they have power. They have a new weapon and they can start using it against others. But the neat thing that I find about all of this amidst all of the power vacuums is the people of all three nations, they end up becoming just pawns in this greater political story. So, for instance, a big example would be the Outer Planets, the OPA, the Belters. They are very loosely organized. They have their own familial relations and things like that. But there's one thing they unify around is that they're looked down upon. They're not really given the same rights as everyone else. There's not as much independence. And there is a very charismatic leader that decides to unite them all under this guise of, this is our common enemy, our hatred of everyone else. And through that unification of like, we can be independent, we can have our own rights, we can have our own, you know, planets, et cetera, ends up being manipulated into this agenda that he just wants revenge and destruction, and everybody kind of goes along with it. And it happens time and time and time again. And it's fascinating how these massive political powers will be manipulating their people. They're just pawns in this grand story of everything. And so that's why I think it's really good world building and just a fascinating story altogether.
So do you think the good world building comes from the diversity of powers or from the vacuum of powers, as you mentioned, where there's constantly an opening to be filled? Or do you think it's coming from the fact that these people come from so many different backgrounds?
Well, sense? Yes, absolutely. Okay. So what we see here is when you have three large power structures, it's this essentially a cosmic balance between any of them. And whether it is a vacuum or whether there is a new weapon that is introduced or something disrupts that balance, everything becomes chaos. And so that's what I love about this world. And I think it's good world, but is when they do see like, oh, suddenly a leader dies, there is now a power vacuum. Everybody, all powers are going to vie for that. This is the opportunity to strike. This is an opportunity to rise a dictator, warlike leader so that we can rebel against these. And there's so many things, but recognizing that power exists and it's orderly so long as things remain the same. But if anything changes, suddenly that's all thrown to chaos. And you have to remember how all powers are going to respond to that.
No, it's just that ties to Emma's example.
Oh, yeah. Right? Oh, totally. As Emma's talking about Hunger Games, I'm like, okay, I got Hunger Games in space. We're good.
Is the nature of the power system, each of these different structures that you're talking about, or the same? Like, is it, because you mentioned like there's a charismatic leader and you've talked about how like leaders will rise and fall. So is it all kind of based on that, like one main figure is in charge of each of these power systems, or are there any that are like more of like a corporation or like a family, or like what sort of
structure is
happening here?
So you can see like the OPA, the Outer Planets, that is your clan like structure. So you have family heads. They are kind of captain of this, of a large ship, and they kind of, and even relations within the ship are very, very unique. The culture, the Belter culture, is very unique, and it kind of reflects in their structure. For instance, they are all polyamorous in particular, because you're all in the same ship and it's just accepted. Like, that's the norm for all of them. But the trading of people between captains and things like that. Whereas you go to Earth and the United Nations, this is very democratic, but in the same way that we would see kind of like democracies here, where even though they're democratically elected, there's still political agendas. There's still like, you know, bad actors in the midst of this that are saying one thing, but really hiding a lot of other things that they're trying to push through. So you see that aspect in that. On the Mars side, this is a group of military people who came to Mars to colonize this planet. And as a result, this is a very harsh living condition. If you make any mistake, people die. So they are very orderly, very structured, very like this, like run like a military. And that's just how society runs there. And it's how their power structures end up running as well. They are strict. They are very intentional, very diligent, and they work really, really hard. But yeah, that's, so you see these two, these three very different ways of structuring things, but how it's almost like the method in which they have these leadership structures and governmental structures doesn't matter, because there's always someone who can step in and manipulate that structure for their own agenda.
I think that summarizes Emma's example and also my example that I'm going to go into. I think that summarizes a lot of political examples. So I feel like that's a natural transition to my example. So my example is the Crescent City series by Sarah J. Maas, specifically the second book, but I'm going to try to not touch on it too much because it only came out fairly recently and I don't want to spoil anything.
Oh, yes.
But a very broad summary. So it's a fantasy world. It takes place on a world called Midgard. So 15,000 years ago on Midgard, it was just humans and animals, basically pseudo Earth. And then the Asteri came. I don't know how to pronounce it. I've only ever read it. A-S-T-E-R-I, Asteri, Asteri. I'm not sure how they pronounce it, but they opened up rifts, and through the rifts came what they call the Vanir. So those are fairies, or fae as they call them, angels, vampires, witches, mermaids, you name it. All these magic wielding or otherwise non-human creatures came through. And when they came through, they brought their powers and they brought their structures with them as well. So the fae are kind of considered upper class. Archangels ruin. That was a Freudian slip. Archangels run. Maybe ruin. Different countries and sections and areas, and they report to the Asteri. And underneath that are the Fae, the High Fae. And then there are shifters, like werewolves, basically, wolf shifters. There are mer people. And every single group in there, there are also like sprites, fire sprites, water sprites, you name it. Every single one has its own structure. It has its own leader. It has its own history. It has all these things. And so they all have these power structures with them, aside realistically from humans who are viewed as lower class. And over all of these veneer structures is the Asteri. And they're holding a secret. I don't want to spoil anything, but it's pretty obvious from the first book. It's very obvious in the second book, but they have a secret, right? So you get to read the series and read the power structure. Even when you're following a mer, there's the blue court, there's the ocean court, there's all these different courts that happen there. And then outside of that, there are the archangels who run different areas, and they have their triarii, which are like their kind of head soldiers who then run their militias. And then in the Crescent City, where it happens, everything happens, there's the auxiliary, which tends to be run by the wolf shifters. And so there are so many different political structures that are happening in this series. It's almost a little confusing. Like I read it at first and it took me a couple times to like really be like, okay, who's the auxiliary again? Kind of thing. But what I found so interesting about it and why I think it's a really good example of world building is that they all kind of suck in their own specific ways. And I like it because even though they're all trying to be good, they're all focusing on the needs of their people, they're all kind of participating in the power play. They're all saying, I wish we didn't have to do this and it's not a good thing to do, but it's in the best interest of our people. And that's what every single faction is saying and doing, right? And there are human rebels who are rebelling against the Asterai, but they're also killing Veneer with reckless abandonment because they don't really care about the fact that they're individuals. They care about establishing human rights. Mm-hmm. So it's so interesting to me in a political field because they all operate in a gray zone. None of them are like purely for the good. None of them are, well, aside from maybe one or two, are purely for the bad. They all kind of suck a little bit, but they're all doing it because they care about the people who answer to them. And I think that's a really interesting example of world building because things aren't always black and white. It's not always pure evil versus pure good. There are people who do things that are questionable for the sake of their purpose. And I think that's why it's a good example.
Yeah, the like examination of being corrupt even when trying to do the right thing is very interesting and like very different than a lot of, you know, evil in sci-fi and fantasy, which we see is kind of just like evil and they know they're evil and they're happy to be evil.
Exactly.
So that's definitely a very interesting example. Now I wonder, I've heard a lot about the Crescent City, actually. I haven't read that one, but now I want to more.
it's good. I will warn you, it's definitely rated R.
Yes, I've heard that about Sarah Gamass's books in general. Yeah.
If you are listening to this and you haven't read her work before, it gets a little saucy. It's a little saucy sometimes. So be prepared for that. But I do enjoy this series the most out of any of her other series, specifically because some of her other books are very like black and white, good versus evil. And this one is like really complicated and weird. And while reading it, I was like, oh yeah, I agree with that. Oh, never mind. I don't know.
Okay. So my question is, what's the secret?
No, that's a spoiler, Kyle.
You have to read the book, Kyle.
Okay, so I hope my follow-up question does not like go back into that territory because it might. Was there a character in the book where you were reading and you're like, I like this character, and then something happened where you just wanted to throw the book, like, I hate you now, how dare you make this decision? Did that happen?
So it's funny, I was actually having this conversation with a friend who loves the book so much because Sarah J. Maas as an author tends to write really stubborn protagonists to the extent of which I get mad at the books and I almost don't even enjoy it. Cause like a stubborn protagonist is good. It's good to have a protagonist who makes decisions that are like a little bit stupid. But sometimes her characters would make decisions that are so stupid, I'm frustrated by it. And I'm like, why in the world would you decide that? So there's so many characters like that in the book where they say, I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to call up this person and leave this angry voicemail. And I'm like, no, come on. You're so smart. Why would you do that? But when it comes to the political side of things, there's so many. That's such a hard question to answer because there are so many where the main character is Bryce Quinlan. And I really love Bryce. I think Bryce is a phenomenal character, but she's very much like that. She's so intensely standing for her morals that sometimes she makes decisions that go against them almost. And it always finds a way to be corrected because, you know, it's a story and it's the main character kind of thing. But I think all the characters are really interesting because they're all grappling in this gray area, right? There's no clear decision. There's no yes or no, this is the right thing to do. And they're all trying to figure it out, where the morals of the universe stand against their own personal morals and how to make a decision that aligns the two it's just really interesting.
What scale is the story told on? Like, is it more from a macro level? Like, is it focusing on the people who are in power and who are making these decisions and that level? Or is it more focused on people who are impacted by these sorts of things, or like smaller people who either are more affected by these decisions or are able to wield their own power, but it might be more unexpected than, you know, someone who's actually like a governmental leader or something like that?
So I would say there's a little bit of there's focus on the people in power. Definitely. They're part of the story, but it focuses on very much a ragtag band of heroes working against this entire system kind of thing. So it's really interesting. There is the one main protagonist, Bryce, but there are probably like 7 or 8 protagonists that they kind of flip through that you'll follow, and they're all different, part of different factions. So, you know, there's a wolf shifter, there's Bryce, who's half human, half fae. And then there's Hunt, who's an angel. And there's, you know, it follows a lot of different people. And I think that also contributes to the storytelling, because it's not just one person working against this big complicated system.
Right.
It's people in different areas of the system comprehending what's happening to them and trying to work against it. Right.
Totally. That makes sense.
So I feel like that's a natural conclusion to the conversation. My Absolutely. Very complicated yep. and yep. very vague description of the series. So we've got a couple announcements before we get into the questions you should ask yourself if you decide to play with this trope in your novel. If you think this podcast is at least $1 worth of education and entertainment, consider supporting the show through Patreon at patreon.com/mythosandinc.
Using the magic of technology to pause time for just a moment here to ask a really important favor. If you're enjoying this podcast and want to hear more of it, the most helpful thing you can do is to write us a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to our podcast. Positive reviews are the number one way for a new podcast to get more listeners, which in turn will let us do all sorts of cool things like transcribe all our episodes, and from recording bi-weekly to maybe even weekly. You can go leave us one right now. I promise I'll keep time paused until you get back.
Just as a reminder, we'll have weekly podcasts until May 4th to make up for our hiatus. So, some concluding questions. What should you ask yourself if you have an evil government in your novel? Emma?
I am going to say that you should ask yourself how political you want your story to be. And I don't mean political in the sense that, you know, questions of morality and that sort of thing are always political. I mean, the nitty gritty, how does your political system work? Are they voting for a representative, or do they vote directly for the person who's going to lead their whole cut? Like that sort of thing. Like, how in detail do you want your political system to be? But more importantly, how in detail does your political system need to be? With all world building, less is usually more. So I'd always say the least amount of information you can give about your political structure to get the story moving forward, generally the better, because readers tend to get confused if you have too many intricate systems and houses and senates and all these sorts of things. However, you know, if that's the kind of story you want to tell, you're going to find an audience for it. There's an audience for everything. So just consider, you know, what level of political intelligence you need your readership to have, or, you know, watchership or gamership or whatever format your story is taking, in order to make your story make sense.
People read and loved Dune. So there are those people that exist.
Yes.
My question begins with: powers that exist uncontested are boring. So, one, don't make it boring. But two, recognize that all powers are balanced in some way. So, what are the things that are keeping your powers balanced from completely taking over everything? And what can you do to disrupt that balance in your story?
That's a great question. My question is, just how evil are they? If it's an evil empire, is it a gray kind of evil? Are they making decisions that benefit to some extent the people they're oppressing enough to keep them quelled? Are they all evil? Is every single person in this government evil, or is it just one bad guy? That's kind of my question. I don't always like a story where it's super black and white. Sometimes you want a lot of players, and a lot of players have a lot of different motivations. So that's what I would ask you to consider. the host of Wayfarer's Guide to Worldbuilding, are also creatives. At the end of each podcast episode, we share a little bit about what we've been up to off air.
So I recently wrapped up a weekly course called Graphic Novels and Medicine, I believe might have been the full title, but it was hosted by Gregory Kamichuk, who is one of Mythos and Inc's own authors. We love him. He did some graphic novels with us, and it was in collaboration with the U of M and their medical program. And I am neither a graphic novelist nor a medical student. However, I joined this course because I really like graphic novels. I find them fascinating. I'd never done anything in that area of sort of creative expression before, and I loved it. I really like graphic novel making. I'm not the best at drawing, but that's all about practice. So I have been working on trying to get better at drawing and working on a little graphic novel project, which I don't know if it'll stay a graphic novel. I might turn it into like a prose novel at some point and kind of just use what I've been doing as storyboards. So we'll see. But I've been really enjoying exploring sort of a new creative avenue. So yeah, that's what I've been up to.
Fascinating. So for me, I have been reigniting my programming roots. And I had an idea of like a program. I should build this. This would be a really good tool for some of these things that I am doing. And then as I was finishing up the tool, I recognized that, or I was told about something called a hackathon, in which is a competition for people building tools that were exactly like the ones I had just built. So I've now entered my program into a hackathon competition in which I could potentially win. Like,
that's amazing.
So yeah, I'm pretty excited. Yeah.
Go, what's Kyle, the prize? Keep us updated.
What's the prize? It's like $10,000.
Holy moly.
There's three prizes of $10,000 and there's like 10 teams. So I'm hoping.
Yeah, no kidding. That's amazing. For me, what I've been up to, I'm currently in grad school getting my master's of professional communications. So a lot of my spare time is dedicated to school, unfortunately. So I'm writing a lot of papers about communications theories, and it's not super creative. But one thing I will say about being a creative in an academic setting is I refuse to use academic writing. You know, like I refuse to use those really lofty sentences that make no sense. And a fun little story, one of my professors gave me feedback, said, strangely clear writing.
Strangely clear.
Strangely clear writing.
What a compliment.
Thank you.
You should have, that'll be the pull quote for your thesis.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Strangely clear. So that's kind of my creative pursuits right now.
If
you're looking for a sci-fi and fantasy writing community on Discord, go to mythosinc.com and join ours. And if you have any questions, suggestions, or comments, email us at podcast@mythosinc.com or tweet to us at @mythosandinc. Until next time, fellow wayfarers, go build worlds.
Bye.
Bye.